Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Sandra Steingraber, believes that fracking is a public health disaster. A biologist who was diagnosed with bladder cancer when she was just 20 years old, Sandra Steingraber has dedicated her career and her life to studying and exposing the ways in which chemical contaminants in the air, water, and food endanger human health. She also says fracking is the environmental issue of our time. Fracking injects a mixture of water, sand, and chemicals under high pressure into dense shale rock formations to crack the rock and then release natural gas. Nearly 700 chemicals are used, according to a recent study by the EPA. So we've done a lot of shows about what we know about those chemicals, and the information's pretty hard to get. The EPA says operators designated 11% of all chemical records as confidential business information. Back in 2011, Sandra Steingraber donated a significant portion of her Heinz Award for Lifetime Achievement to provide the seed money to help create a coalition of 500 anti-fracking groups. Within a few years, New Yorkers Against Fracking successfully fought for and achieved a statewide ban on fracking. In late December, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced plans to ban fracking because of health concerns. It was a major victory for anti-fracking advocates across the country. And joining us to talk about the industry and the latest science on fracking is Dr. Sandra Steingraber, an environmental writer who spent 15 days or was sentenced to 15 days in jail in November for protesting fracking. She's the author of Living Downstream, an ecologist's personal investigation of cancer and the environment. Breast Cancer Action is honoring Sandra at its 25th anniversary event tonight, and I will be emceeing and interviewing Sandra on stage. You can find information about that at yourcallradio.org. Sandra will also be speaking on Monday at 5:30. She's giving a talk about California fracking at School of the Sacred Heart. That's 2222 Broadway in San Francisco, and that is a free event. And Sandra joins me in studio. Hi, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Rose. It's
great to have you in studio. You know, I remember reading about the ban on fracking in New York, and we've had a lot of activists in California on the show, and they were just elated. And I just want you to talk about the significance of this decision, because I remember this quote from Dr. Howard Zucker. He is New York's acting state health commissioner. And he said his review about fracking boiled down to a simple question. Would he want his family to live in a community where fracking was taking place? And his answer was no. How significant is this ban?
Well, that's, of course, the way you want doctors to make decisions, right? The medical doctor, Dr. Zucker, who is head of our state health department, said that, as far as he was concerned, the people of New York are his patients, and so it's his job to prevent harm and keep people safe, and that's what he did. Behind that decision, of course, there was a lot of work, and so from my point of view, and I should say that this was an opera, right, with a cast of thousands of people, and science played one role, and not the only role. There were law played a big role too, because it turned out that a lot of communities were able to use their own municipal zoning laws to zone fracking out, and that was also determinative. But I'm not a lawyer; I'm a biologist, and I do public health. So the way I tell the story is just from my own vantage point, which is just one of many, right? So, from my point of view, what we in the public health community achieved during the years that we fought against the gas industry was the ability to take the emerging science and bring it straight out to the people of New York and just educate them on what the science showed. And what we learned by doing that was the more people learned about fracking, the more they didn't want it in their state. And so I spent the better part of 2 years, I think, with a team of other doctors, biologists, engineers, biochemists, and so on, speaking in, I think, every church basement in upstate New York, it feels like, and rotary clubs and town halls and libraries and these little communities, and just doing our PowerPoint presentations on what the data show. And that moved the needle on public opinion. And, of course, once that starts happening, governors We need to pay attention.
And so really it was good old-fashioned organizing, because you and all of the activists, the doctors, the scientists, are up against a very powerful, very wealthy industry. And so in 2011, you donated a portion of your Heinz Award for Lifetime Achievement to provide the seed money to create this coalition of 500 anti-fracking groups, New Yorkers Against Fracking. Talk a little bit about the conversations, how you started, and what your goal was to actually reach people and let them know what the science actually said.
Right. So to be clear, we ended up as 500 organizations, and we were kind of a mighty coalition. But in the early days, there were only five groups and plus me. And it wasn't the first time that we had tried to kind of unite the tribes across the state to let the anti-fracking voice speak, to be, you know, a statewide voice rather than just lots of there were lots of little groups in different communities speaking out, right? But it was like the civil rights movement before the Alabama bus boycotts, you know, that we hadn't come together. And we tried to do that once and it failed, and everyone went home mad and crying and upset. And so so it took several false starts. So what we did when we created New Yorkers Against Fracking ultimately was just bring in a few like-minded groups and start small rather than trying to unite everybody under one banner, which no one could agree on what the ask would be. Some people wanted better regulated fracking. Some people wanted to criminalize fracking. Some wanted a moratorium, some a ban. So we just took a few groups that could work together well, and we just started to go. And then as we got a little traction, other groups joined us, and we had open door policy, you know, as long as people could agree that our goal was a statewide ban.
And so in this soundbite world that we live in, I mean, the nice thing about doing organizing on the ground is people want to be involved in forums and get more information. But when you talk about fracking, what is your main argument against it? You say that it's the environmental issue of our time and that it's a public health disaster.
Well, fracking cannot be made safe under any regulatory framework, according to the data we have available to us now. So you can't point to any study to say, oh, here's the way you can do fracking without harming people. In fact, the data show just the opposite. And so, you know, one of our other messages is that you just can't experiment on people without their consent. That's just not right. And so if we don't have evidence that it can be done safely, which we don't, and we do have not absolute proof, but emerging evidence that show a lot of troubling signs, then the right thing to do is declare a moratorium until the science can sort itself out. And that's the message we bring to California, too.
Right. And we'll talk about California. But those of us who've seen Gasland know that people are being experimented on in places like Wyoming, Colorado, Texas. And so talk a little bit about what the science says on how fracking actually affects health.
Sure. So in fact, next week, my little shop, Concerned Health Professionals of New York, together with Physicians for Social Responsibility, are releasing the third edition of our compendium of findings on the risks and harms of fracking. So the reason we keep releasing these new editions every few months is because the science keeps flowing forward. And so since our last edition last December, right before the fracking ban came out, there have been more than 100 new studies in the peer-reviewed scientific literature. And so when we first achieved a temporary moratorium in New York, there were only six studies. And then now there are more than between 500 and 600 studies. Mm. And so now we have, if you can imagine, like a 500-piece jigsaw puzzle, where each study alone tells you a little something, but it's when you put them all together that the pattern begins to emerge. And so what this compendium shows is that fracking is definitively linked to water contamination. It always is accompanied by air pollution, and that people who live near drilling and fracking operations have health problems. And in fact, I was just on the phone right before I got in the cab to come to the station talking with doctors and nurses about a brand new study just out today from Johns Hopkins University that shows that of 10,000 women who are pregnant in Pennsylvania, those who lived closest to and had the most drilling and fracking activity around them during their pregnancies had much higher risks for preterm birth and high-risk pregnancy. So we were just talking about those data. Those aren't even going to be in our compendium because we just finally put the last footnote. There's like 683 footnotes, and we can't go back and tear it apart again. But The data keep coming out. That's the point. And so science is slow. The wheels of scientific proof-making grind very slowly. Fracking was a shale rush. You know, it covered the nation before the science could get done. But now that the science is coming out, the question is what do you do, and who gets to decide, and how much information do you need to decide?
Right, and it's moving very quickly. Gas production from shale has nearly doubled since 2010, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. It accounted for 47% of natural gas production in 2013. So where is fracking moving the fastest today?
Well, fracking is actually going through a kind of bust phase now. So it's all the signs that we can see are that because the price of gas is so low, and oil also. I mean, this, remember, we're fracking, especially in California, fracking for oil rather than for gas, and similarly in North Dakota.
Right.
So we're actually seeing a dropping off of activity, which is for many of us believe is a good thing. Mm-hmm. But remember the. Even though we have these signs of a public health menace due to the chemical exposures of fracking from via air and water, for example, there's another huge public health threat from fracking, and that is via climate change, which is, according to the World Health Organization, climate change is the number one public health menace to children living today. So here we are in a time of climate emergency, blowing up the nation's bedrock to extract, you know, more climate-killing gas and oil. So there's a parallel movement, of course, the climate change movement, that the new rallying cry is, you know, leave it in the ground. And because even natural gas, if we lay out the infrastructure for it and invest energy investment dollars that direction, we close the door for what we know we need for reasons of climate change, which is renewable energy. So there are kind of two interrelated reasons. They both have to do with public health, but one has to do with the inherent leakiness of oil and gas extraction operations, and what they leak is unburned methane. Mm. And methane is a very powerful heat-trapping gas, far more powerful, actually, than carbon dioxide.
What do we know today about the chemicals? The EPA found at least 700 reported chemicals used in the process of fracking. And we've done a lot of shows about the chemicals, and the guests say that it's very hard to get this information. So what do we know today about those chemicals?
We don't know any more than what you, okay. You probably already talked to your guests about. So there's a veil of secrecy that surrounds fracking on many different levels, and that has really blinded the scientific process. The science works best when we can have all the data on the table and then look for patterns. And so by hiding the chemicals used in the name of trade secrets, which no other industry gets to do, right? If you release your chemicals beyond the factory walls into the community, air, water, soil, food, where that people that will go into their bodies, then people have the right to know. We have right to know laws. We got them in 1986, and they work really well. And I've spent a lot of my time looking at right to know data, looking and trying to compare where the toxic waste sites are to where the birth defects are to where the cancer clusters are. That's what I do. Mm. But I can't even do that work with fracking because we don't know what the chemicals are being used. But science has kind of evolved workarounds to that. So we can, for example, measure what's in the worker's urine, and there's benzene at high levels, high enough to that we know raises your risk significantly for leukemia. So we know that workers are being exposed to benzene, for example. We can do we can capture air samples around compressor stations and wellheads and find high levels of things like formaldehyde and so on. And so and we know that people who live near compressor stations that pressurize the gas after it leaves the well and puts it into the pipeline, that whenever there are big releases of chemicals, people experience, we can measure what those chemicals are. People self-report certain kind of symptoms that we know from other data are linked to, let's say, exposure to solvents and so on. So there's ways around it that we in the scientific community are figuring out. But it's a very difficult, studying fracking is the most difficult subject I've ever encountered in public health.
Dr. Sandra Steingraber is a biologist and environmental writer. She's the author of Living Downstream, an ecologist's personal investigation of cancer and the environment. In 2011, she helped create a coalition of 500 anti-fracking groups that actually started as a coalition of about five and then grew very quickly. And within a few years, New Yorkers Against Fracking successfully fought for and achieved a statewide ban on fracking. In late December, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced plans to ban fracking because of health concerns. And Sandra will be honored tonight at Breast Cancer Action's 25th anniversary event in San Francisco. And she will be speaking Monday at School of the Sacred Heart. She'll talk about California fracking and public health. That's 222 Broadway Street, 530. You can find more information about both events at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about fracking and public health? And then we will also talk about chemicals, because we've actually had Sandra on a few times talking about chemicals and how that's affecting our air, our bodies, and our just the planet in general. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Denny in Richmond. Hi, Denny. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. And hi, Sandra. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks. How are you, Denny?
Great. Well, my question was about the infrastructure problems that New York is experiencing due to the fact that Pennsylvania and other states don't have fracking bans. We've been working with the Catskill Mountain Keeper and just issued a peer-reviewed report about samples by compressor stations at Hungry Hill up there in New York. But I want to hear more about the activities that are going on in your coalition because of the impacts of infrastructure, even though you don't have fracking.
Okay, so everyone needs to know this is Denny Larson, who's actually very, very wonderful researcher in the field of public health, known to all of us. I didn't know that that's the Denny I was talking to, but now I do.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for everything you do, Denny. So, yeah, indeed, New York has banned the process of fracking itself, and for that, we're so pleased to, you know, our governor deserves an incredible amount of credit. He's a kind of a hero to us for making that step. But meanwhile, the state just below us, Pennsylvania, is just being fracked to pieces, and even though the price of gas is so low, all of these operations are kind of run by debt, and so they're, in order to keep going, they have to just keep blasting the gas out of the ground as fast as they can, even though logically it might make sense to wait for the price to go up. And so these are gases, right? And you have to have a place to store it. You have to get it in pipelines. You have to compress it. You have to get it to market. And so most of the dense markets for gas, the Eastern Seaboard, run right through New York State. And so now we're fighting a second battle, which is a battle against compressor stations, pipelines, and in my own particular community, it's a battle against gas storage. So I live near a lake where for 100 years salt mining has gone on the banks of that lake. And there are these caverns under the ground that are the size of cathedrals, 120 of them. And a Houston-based gas company has purchased all that prime lakefront property along with the gas, along with the salt plant, not because it's interested in making salt available to the world, but rather to get its hands on these holes in the ground to store fracked gases. So we're trying to close the door to that. In fact, that it was my involvement in that a resistance that led me to do civil disobedience and go to jail. So it wasn't an action against fracking itself, but rather against gas storage. And so we feel also ethically obliged to close the door on fracking infrastructure, because by allowing our woods and fields and communities to be the staging ground for fracking infrastructure, we aid and abet fracking in other states, including Pennsylvania. And also we create misery and ruin and health problems for everyone downwind for that. So now our attention turns to fracking infrastructure. Our governor has some very ambitious plans, as does the governor of California, for renewable energy. And that's great. But our message to both governors, and my message is specific to Jerry Brown that I'll be talking about on Monday night, is that you have to do, it's a two-fisted struggle. You say yes to renewables, but you also have to leave the fossils in the ground. If you don't say no to fracking and fracking infrastructure, then it's going to be blasted out, and it's just your state ends up getting turned into a kind of a bus terminal for all this fossil fuel to go elsewhere in the world, where it will be burned and destroy the climate. So you have to do two things at the same time, say no to fracking and say yes to renewables. That's our message now.
What would you say about the differences between New York and California when it comes to the power of the oil industry? Because Jerry Brown recently basically admitted that the oil industry has so much power in California, and that's why the Democrats had to drop the oil reduction target from the climate change bill. And this got a lot of headlines last month.
It's time for Democrats and everyone else to find some courage, because By making that kind of admission, what you're admitting is that an industry has become more powerful than a government, and a government can no longer protect its people. I don't think Governor Jerry Brown wants that to be his legacy. I don't think it should be his legacy. So it's really time now the fossil fuel party is over. That's what the science shows. And it's I think that elected officials have more power than they know. I think scientists have more power than they know. And it's not what we're realizing now, as in the scientific community, is it's not enough for us to simply publish our data and be done with it, because the industry is so powerful, it won't let policy be made on what the data show. And so we actually have to take the data ourselves into the political and public arena and show it to voters, show it to policymakers, and insist that policies be made based on what the evidence shows. And what the evidence shows is that, you know, Governor Brown, if you want to be a climate leader, you cannot allow the bedrock of California to be fractured and all the oil that it contains to be exhumed and burned. That you can't wear the mantle of a climate leader and still do that.
Right. And because this is so important, I just want to talk about the specifics of this. Senate President Pro Tem Kevin DeLeon spoke in Sacramento last month, and he announced amendments to the Senate Bill 350 that deleted a key goal to cut Californians' use of petroleum and gas 50% by 2030. He said he'd been unable to compete with the oil industry's, quote, bottomless war chest. He said, "I don't think we've seen an amount of money spent like we have seen in the last 4 months. Tens of millions of dollars spent to create this smokescreen of deception with high-priced negative advertising."
Yeah, it's a terrible defeat, right? But that should make us fight even harder, because we're fighting for life itself. And in California, a state that's been devastated by drought, we know that climate change is only going to make it worse. But if we accelerate climate change further by fracking, we're using our precious freshwater resources to do that. And what the data show here in California is that it's because the oil and the gas here in California are actually located in more shallow rock formations than they are in other states. So you don't actually need as much water to frack in California. The problem is what to do with all the wastewater when you're done. And it's the injection of the wastewater back in the ground that has contaminated whole aquifers here in California in a time of drought. And that is an ethical problem. It's a biological problem. It requires everybody's attention. And so everyone needs to bring their own skill set to this issue. You know, we fought wars over fossil fuels, and we said no blood for oil. Here in California, it's really we're exchanging our precious freshwater resources, what little we have here, for the very substance that's killing the planet. That's the hostage exchange program that's going on, and it requires all of us to be engaged in that.
And we're at a point where some people living in the Central Valley do not have any running water. Their wells have run dry. They are relying on bottled water. Hold that thought. I want to ask you more about that after the break. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Sandra Steingraber. She's a biologist and an environmental writer. And today, we are talking about fracking and the public health and environmental concerns around fracking. We'll be back after this. ¶¶
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll be discussing media coverage of the U.S. airstrikes on Doctors Without Borders Hospital in Afghanistan, which killed 22 people. The organization is accusing the U.S. government of committing war crimes. So how are the media framing that deadly attack? We'll also talk about coverage of the Supreme Court's new session. This term, decisions will affect so many crucial issues, including affirmative action, abortion, voting, unions, and more. That is tomorrow. And if you have a guest idea or a show idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, I am speaking with Dr. Sandra Steingraber, a biologist and environmental writer. She has dedicated her life to studying and exposing the ways in which chemical contaminants in the air, water, and food endanger human health. And in 2011, she donated a significant portion of her Heinz Award for Lifetime Achievement to provide the seed money to help create a coalition of anti-fracking groups. It grew very quickly, and it grew to 500. In December, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced plans to ban fracking because of health concerns. Sandra will be speaking. Actually, she'll be honored tonight at the Breast Cancer Action's 25th anniversary event. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And she'll be speaking on Monday at 5:30 at School of the Sacred Heart, 2222 Broadway Street. She'll be talking about California fracking and public health concerns. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I just want to ask you, because you have so much experience with chemicals and public health, it's kind of shocking to me to see what's happening in California, where we have people living without running water. And in Fort Bragg, I thought this was a satirical article, frankly. High-end restaurants are now serving food on paper plates because they don't want to use water to wash the dishes. And I'm wondering what you think about that and how you think state officials should be responding, because I think we should be in a state of emergency, and it just doesn't feel like one.
I agree with you. We're all 65% water by weight, so we are the water we drink. When water disappears, whole communities disappear. I mean, life just can't go on. Once you start relying on bottled water, water is also heavy. It weighs 8 pounds a gallon. So if you're burning fossil fuels to deliver water, then you're in a real death spiral, it seems to me. So the problem with using water as an instrument to blow apart bedrock to get more fossil fuels out means we're only accelerating the problem rather than solving it. We're going in the exact wrong direction. And where most of the fracking in California actually takes place is in the San Joaquin Valley in Kern County. And this is a place that's, first of all, densely populated. It also, because it's in the valley, already has pre-existing air pollution problems. And so when you add fracking on top of that, Kern County is now the fifth most ozone polluted county, which an ozone, ground level ozone, is smog, and it's a terrible public health problem linked to preterm birth, heart attack and stroke risk, perhaps even dementia and cognitive decline in the elderly, and certainly childhood asthma and so on. And so the medical care costs, at the same time, you can bankrupt a state simply by the costs of air pollution. So all of these things point to needing to do something very, very different. What's interesting to us in the East about where fracking takes place in California is what lies on top of the bedrock in Kern County is, of course, one of the richest agricultural regions in the world. And so the food that's grown there feeds us all. And so we're actually distributing the risks because fracking waste is now being used in irrigation for some of that food. So, again, it's one of those unintended consequences of recognizing that California should never have allowed fracking waste to be injected into freshwater aquifers. Once you close the door on doing that, what are you going to do with all this waste? There's no technology to turn that poisoned water from fracking into fresh, potable, drinkable water again. We just don't know how to do that. So it has to be safely contained forevermore. So what's happening now in the Central Valley is the recycling, if you will, of that water into actually irrigation. And so you could ask the scientific community, what do we know about the ability of plant roots to uptake some of the chemicals we know are in the fracking waste, and are we being exposed through eating? And we'll have to say, gee, we don't know. We'll have to do the research. And then again, science goes slowly while the industry is allowed to kind of have a free hand. That's the problem.
We have an email from Charles who says, many thanks to Sandra for this important work. I was arrested on December 17th, 2014 at Seneca Lake for taking part in a We Are Seneca Lake blockade at Crestwood. After I was released by the Watkins Glen police, I was greeted by the news that the state of New York had banned fracking. What a great day. Sandra, thank you so much for all you've done for this important movement.
That was a great day.
Thank you, Charles, for writing in. Well, now I would like to welcome in our next guest, Susan Nagel. She's Associate Professor of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Women's Health at University of Missouri. She's led a study published in the journal Endocrinology, which found elevated levels of endocrine-disrupting activity in surface water and groundwater samples collected near natural gas drilling dense areas in Garfield County, Colorado. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us. So tell us about this study that was just published, which found elevated levels of endocrine disrupting activity in surface water and groundwater samples.
Sure. We collected water samples at sites that had some sort of spill related to the wastewater from fracturing for natural gas and oil. And what we found was elevated levels of endocrine-disrupting activity. That is particularly what we study, and the ability to disrupt estrogens and androgens, which are female and male sex hormones.
And so what does that mean exactly? I mean, talk a little bit more about what that means for public health.
Sure. So what we know from occupational exposure and from a very large literature on endocrine-disrupting chemicals, what we can expect, although we haven't done the studies yet to show, what we can expect are really all kinds of negative health outcomes related to fertility, related to the ability to get pregnant, to stay pregnant. Certainly reduced sperm counts have been associated with exposure, both in people and in the lab. Also, other types of effects that we expect are developmental effects. So when unborn children are exposed, they are a particularly sensitive population, and even young children. And in that case, the brain is exquisitely sensitive to endocrine-disrupting chemicals. And so what we've seen over and over again is that exposure changes behavior, increases activity and all sorts of other behaviors that are not normal.
How did the industry respond to this report?
The industry was certainly very critical of it, and it was a proof of principle from our perspective. We chose sites that we knew had had spills because we wanted to test the hypothesis that these spills could contaminate surface and groundwater, and we found an association. We did not prove that those spills were the cause of the increased endocrine disrupting activity in the water. But it was a proof of principle and has really encouraged us to continue investigating whether this happens and to show more definitively the source of the chemicals. We've also shown that independently in the laboratory, we have shown that the chemicals used in this process can disrupt a whole variety of hormone receptors.
Well, when you look at the medical field and the research that's being done right now, Susan, what concerns you the most about fracking? We were just talking earlier about the fact that we don't really know, still we don't know much about the 700 chemicals that are used.
Right. I'm repeating myself, but what does concern me the most is exposure to our most sensitive populations. And those are our women who are considering getting pregnant. Those are women who are pregnant and their unborn children, and certainly young children as well.
Well, let's take another caller. Let's go to Rebecca in San Rafael. Hi, Rebecca. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. I'm curious what our guest Susan knows about the notice mailed out to Californians from the California Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources on the proposed aquifer exemption, and also what the best practices were for the movement in New York, the ones they used to get the state to ban fracking.
And the letter that you received was about an aquifer exemption?
Yes, and I believe it went out to all Californians in the last week, and it was from a group called Dogger, the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources.
I never got anything about that. Can you elaborate on what else the letter said?
Well, essentially it said there'll be a notice of public comment hearing, but they went into quite a bit of detail about trying to align or not with the U.S. government's rules and regulations on fracking, and whether or not California would do that or go their own way. And really I'm asking because I couldn't really make sense of the letter. It was sort of almost proposing both sides of, you know, do we do this or do we do that, and what should we do, and who has exemptions and who's in compliance and not. And so I was just a little confused and wondering if our guests knew anything about it.
Sandra?
I don't, but I'll bet Californians Against Fracking are all over that. So I would refer to, our listener to just to Google Californians Against Fracking, and there's likely something on the website about that. Dogger is, in fact, an agency within the state government. There is an issue about whether or not the aquifers that had been used to as a repository for fracking waste, whether that was in violation of EPA guidelines or not. So I suspect that has to do with that outstanding question, but I don't know the details of it. I'll probably know more by Monday and could maybe speak about it then.
All right. And well, thank you. And if you can make Sandra's talk on Monday, she's speaking at 5:30 at the School of the Sacred Heart, 2222 Broadway Street, 5:30. It's a free event. She'll be talking about California fracking. When we have government officials on the show, and once in a while an oil executive, they tell us that the methods used in California are not what they used to be. They're not as intensive. And so can you talk about that? I mean, do the methods across the country change greatly? And what kind of difference does that make?
Certainly, fracking is practiced differently in California than it is elsewhere. So in the new edition of our compendium next week, we separate out the whole discussion about California because it is so different. And that has to do with geology. The shale formations are also more fissured and fractured and faulted because of the seismic activity here in California. The oil and gas are held in different shallower formations. And there's also other techniques like acidizing, which refers to actually melting the rock away with acids rather than blowing it up with water and hydraulic pressure. And so those are important differences, but the similarities are, at the end of the day, more important. You cannot get oil and gas out of the ground without releasing methane. You cannot do this without a lot of air pollution. You cannot do this without sacrificing water. So you can change the recipe a little bit and change the technology a little bit. But the fact is that many of the risks, there are more risks in common than there are different. And then remember that we're doing new fracking or acidizing or whatever we're doing it on top of all the old wells that were done with the old methods, and so they're still out there. And as long as there are holes drilled that connect the surface and our aquifers to the oil and gas bearing formations, then there are pathways and conduits that when you frack a new way or acidize in a new way, you can those old abandoned holes in the ground are still there. So there's only so much Swiss cheese you can make, so many pins that you can stick into the earth before those old pathways create risks. You know, you can, these things are connected underground. Mm. So the risks are cumulative.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Rebecca. Let's go next to Ed in Santa Cruz. Hi, Ed. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I wanted to talk about methyl bromide, another chemical problem that we have that's poisoning people here in Monterey Bay area, especially in the around the strawberry fields. Methyl bromide has been used now for 20 years against the treaty which outlawed it, Montreal Protocol in the mid-80s. Methyl bromide was banned worldwide because it's one of the most toxic substances on Earth, and it even up the ozone layer. Well, our congressman here, Sam Farr, who's still in office, and he's going to run again for this coming year, he got an exemption for methyl bromide for the strawberry growers because they support him to get reelected. They give him money every year, and he goes out and gets them exempted every year. So what the consequences are, and I'm glad you have a guest who's an OBGYN, because the consequences are, especially for pregnant women, the UC Berkeley School of Public Health did a study down here and found that the closer that a pregnant woman lives to the methyl bromide strawberry fields, the lower the birth weight of their babies, which means lifelong medical complications for those babies. And for the farm workers and the school children right across the fence from the fields and the residents across, here again is another example of our government turning itself into a private corporate enterprise. That's really what it is. I mean, the problems that you mentioned with Governor Brown and Kevin DeLeon earlier about the power of the corporations over the entire process of government is so overwhelming that that's what we have, is a private enterprise for a government now. And so I would like your guest to comment, if she could, about the consequences for pregnant mothers and what she thinks could be done to try to get rid of this methyl bromide.
Susan, can you take that question?
I can try. It is certainly listed as an endocrine disruptor by the EU. It is not one that I am familiar with personally in my lab, so I can't speak as specifically about exposure. But certainly I would agree with you that there is evidence to suggest that there will be negative health consequences for both the pregnant mom and her unborn baby, and that those could be very long-lasting.
You reminded me of a piece by the Center for Investigative Reporting. They did an entire expose on strawberries and chemicals in California back in January. And in January, California regulators ruled that the state's farmers must restrict their use of chlorpicrin. Are you familiar with that? It's a toxic pesticide widely used to prepare soil for planting. And they found that California's use of this chemical increased 650% from 1991 to 2012. And apparently this is causing farm workers to vomit because it's so toxic.
Yes, certainly there are acute toxic effects to those that are exposed, adults that are exposed, absolutely. Certainly, though, the long-term effects, these chemicals are designed specifically to disrupt hormone signaling in plants and animals. And we're animals, and so they do disrupt hormone signaling in people. And we go to some length to regulate these and to limit exposure and to protect sensitive populations, but we do not always succeed.
Well, thank you for that call. I'm glad you brought this up. There's an amazing story. It's called Dark Side of the Strawberry, an investigative story by the Center for Investigative Reporting, now Reveal, actually. Today, we are joined by Susan Nagel, Associate Professor of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Women's Health at the University of Missouri. She led a study published in the journal Endocrinology, which found elevated levels of endocrine-disrupting activity in surface water and groundwater samples collected near fracking drilling dense areas in Garfield County, Colorado. We're also joined by Dr. Sandra Steingraber, a biologist and environmental writer, author of Living Downstream. She will be honored at tonight's Breast Cancer Action's 25th anniversary event in San Francisco and speaking Monday at the School of the Sacred Heart, 2222 Broadway Street at 5:30. She'll be talking about California fracking. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. And we have an email from a listener, Sandra, wanting to know more about what really worked in New York and what advice would you give to activists in California who are fighting fracking?
It's science that won the fracking battle in New York. The science should be able to persuade. The science is the same in all states, right? And so it should be persuasive everywhere. On the other hand, the science on tobacco was persuasive in 1964 that we should have had smoke-free workplaces, but it took the science to be taken into the public arena by scientists, but also by other kind of champions to insist that that the policies respond to what the science says, because our regulatory system has kind of become deaf to the emerging science. And so from my point of view, and again, I'm just a biologist. If you brought one of the many wonderful attorneys that use zoning laws to create local bans across the state, they would say that's what did it. And so there's no one answer to the question, but from the glimpse that I had when we were working on this issue, the science was really determinative, and that's what the governor used to ban fracking, rightfully so. And it was a health review done by our own DOH that demonstrated the harms of it. But we needed to bring that science out of the obscurity of the peer-reviewed literature, translate it into plain English, both in the form of a compendium that we could just not publish in a hard to find place with under subscription, but rather just put it out on a website so anyone could use. We needed to take that evidence and bring it to health professionals so that they could organize themselves around it and speak in one voice, but also faith leaders, because this is as Susan says, when our most vulnerable people, our infants, our pregnant women are harmed, there's faith leaders listen to that. That's their job too. And so we had 500 faith leaders against fracking as part of our coalition. They were apostles for the message on science. And so it was all of that together that opened up a space in the culture for the science to speak.
How did you deal with the merchants of doubt? This is a term coined by the scientist Naomi Oreskes. There's an amazing documentary about this. Have you seen it?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
We did a show about it recently. And so these are basically the pundits who are hired, who present themselves as authorities as they talk about things like toxic chemicals, pharmaceuticals, climate change, fracking. They've got a ton of money behind them, and they're really good liars, frankly. I mean, they know how to speak in sound bites, and the media love these people. So how did you deal with them?
Well, the gas industry and the oil industry clearly taking a page out of the tobacco playbook, where you simply, every time there's a study that shows, like the one that just came out today, showing that the babies born to mothers who live in Pennsylvania around a lot of drilling and fracking activity have a 40% higher risk of being born preterm and so on. And so, I mean, those are the kind of studies that we highlight, because the question is not, is there another study that shows something else? There are two questions. One is, what does the predominant evidence show? And when we took a look at all of the studies in the peer-reviewed literature, 80-some percent of them found a connection. So the overwhelming number of studies found a connection. The science isn't split, in other words. So we point to that. And then also the question is, even if the science were to be split, and you don't really know what it is. Is it right to expose people without their consent until you figure this out? Are you not, if you do that, are you not turning people into guinea pigs? Mm. And then turning the science of public health into a kind of jobs creation program for epidemiologists who are going to create registries and study everyone, but not stop the harm from happening. That's not what we do. I mean, that's not ethical, you know. And that's why having faith leaders standing side by side with scientists is a powerful coalition and an alliance.
And Susan, what are your thoughts on the Merchants of Doubt as a professor who's trying to get this information out there, publishing studies about elevated levels of endocrine disrupting activities in groundwater samples collected near fracking sites?
You know, I think it's just a very powerful message that the public needs to hear often, that it is a very effective product protection strategy to introduce any amount of doubt. And if the public knows that, they can be much more skeptical about, you know, when they hear things like experts disagree. It is, as Sandra said, the weight of the evidence that we are mostly interested in and not, you know, creating doubt. So I think it's certainly about putting that knowledge and that power in the consumer.
And Sandra, what's the status of the people who have already had health concerns? The Gasland, for example, interviewed so many people who feel like what they're dealing with is directly related to fracking in their backyards. Have you been following them? Is there a place where we can find out how they're doing?
There is a website called List of the Harmed where these stories are told. And there's also a ongoing documentary project called Shale Field Stories that you can Google. And so, what we say in science is that you know, the plural of anecdote is not data. On the other hand, you can't ignore those anecdotes because in medicine, certainly by listening to patients, you form hypotheses, and then you can go out and actually gather the data. So when all kinds of children are presenting with nosebleeds, for example, what do we know about what causes nosebleeds? And exposure to solvents, especially formaldehyde, can do that. So then we know that that's a sign that we should maybe go out and do some air sampling and see if there's formaldehyde coming off this flare stack or this compressor station. And lo and behold, if there is, then we're on to something, right? Mm-hmm. So you keep putting the breadcrumbs together and following the trail, following where the data leads is a very powerful thing. I believe in that. The problem in a story like fracking is that, again, that process is very slow and deliberative, and scientists we're more likely to say we haven't found something than we have because we never want to retract something. So we're very conservative, and that's a good thing about science, is how conservative it is. But when you're up against a very fast-moving industry, then there's a disparity in how fast things move.
Dr. Sandra Steingraber is an environmental writer and biologist. She will be honored tonight at Breast Cancer Action's 25th anniversary event in San Francisco. And she will be speaking on Monday, School of the Sacred Heart, at 5:30 about California fracking. And Susan Nagel is associate professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and women's health at the University of Missouri. Susan and Sandra, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of U.S. airstrikes on Doctors Without Borders Hospital in Afghanistan, which killed 22 people. The organization is accusing the U.S. government of committing war crimes. How are the media framing the deadly attack? We'll also discuss coverage of the Supreme Court's new session. The term's decisions will affect several crucial issues, including affirmative action, abortion, voting, and unions. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.